Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
First up this morning, we've got a competition to win tickets to see the Pet Shop Boys at the Marquee in Cork on June the 9th. The tickets cost €65. They're on sale from Ticketmaster.ie from this coming Friday at 9 a.m. But this morning, I have a pair to give away. And all you need to do is answer this very difficult question. The two members of the Pet Shop Boys are called Neil and Chris, Ted and Dougal, or Donald and Mickey. You can send your answer to 51551 with your name and address, and I'll read out the winner at the end of today's show. We're now also going to start with some music. Good morning to Alfie and Harry Hudson Taylor, known as Hudson Taylor. Thanks for coming in
on this unearthly hour
on a Sunday morning. You're going to sing live for us. I know your new album's just out, Loving Everywhere I Go.
Yeah.
Brilliant. And you're going to come back later on and sing another song, but what are you going to start us off with?
We're going to start with a song on the album called Old Soul.
Off you go.
Thank you.
Look at the fire as it burns out. Look at the time, where are you now? I wanna be there when you get cold. You know, I'm an old soul. You're an old soul. We are dreamers. I believe. As it grows old, who would have thought it was pure gold? I wanna be there when it's set in stone. I'm an old soul. You're an old soul. We are dreamers. I believe. I was scared, so unprepared for me to fall in love. But you were there, you were where I found my freedom. Oh, I'm an old soul. You're an old soul.
That was beautiful, Alfie and Harry, otherwise known as Hudson Taylor. Thank you so much
thank
for that.
You,
and that's
Mary,
from your new album, Loving Everywhere I Go. And when you come back later, I know that you're in the Olympia on the 24th of April.
Yes, yeah.
And you're tonight in Cabinets in Portlaoise.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you're going to the Opera House in Cork on the 25th of
yes.
April and the Big Top in Limerick on the
yeah.
3rd of May.
Yeah,
yeah I'll
yes.
mention them again later.
Thank you very
you
much.
You go up to our canteen and have a good old fry
I
up.
I'll have a nice coffee, but thank you so much for
yeah,
having us.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Chat to you later on. Well, in her super successful and prolific career, playwright Marina Carr has journeyed from the Midlands of her childhood in plays such as On Raftery's Hill, Portia Coughlin and By the Bog of Cats, but also to ancient Greece in her retelling of the stories of Hecuba and Phaedra. This year, she has adapted Virginia Woolf's novel to The Lighthouse, has a new play, The Boy for the Abbey, Gilgamesh with Mockness for Galway 2020, and she teaches writing at DCU. And if that isn't enough, this month, Marina Carr's great play, The May, makes a return to the stage, this time at the Gaiety Theatre. And she joins me now. I'm exhausted even reading all that, Marina Carr.
I'm exhausted listening to it.
Well done, you. Listen, tell me about The May. You wrote it, is it in 1994?
Well, yeah, way back anyway.
What is it about?
Well, it's about a woman who builds a house to lure back her husband who has left her. And she builds this beautiful house on this lake and he comes back and all hell breaks loose. And I suppose it's also about the generations of women in the family, the aunts and the great-grandmother, Grandma Frecklin, and then her children. So it's a generational story.
And how would you describe, it's interesting because I have two female playwrights on today, two great playwrights, yourself and Nancy Harris, and you often both write about female themes and women and strong women, but imperfect women as well, which I love. So yeah. How would you describe the women in The May?
Well, they're fairly cantankerous. They love a good scrap. I suppose The May is a perfectionist and quite a demanding woman and a bit of a dreamer and believes in the great love story that is her and her husband. He doesn't quite believe that. I imagine she's probably very difficult to live with. She's such a perfectionist. But there's something, I think there's something very pure about her and something very innocent about her. And then the shattering of that life has terrible consequences for her and for all of the family. And it impacts. But it's also about the stories, I think, that women pass down, like the matriarchal line, I suppose, and how we position ourselves in the world, how we're allowed to position ourselves, and what we can do to break out of that very, I suppose, constrained, historically constrained idea of what it is to be a woman in this society.
And interestingly, you wrote in 94, as you say, very early on in your career. So it's being revived now. It's going to, you know, be on in the Gaiety. Do you look at the women you've written differently now? And are they now living in a different world than it was in 1994 for women? Or is it all terribly much the same?
Well, some things are the same and some things are. I think there are more opportunities now, slightly more than when I started out. When I look at the young generations coming up, like my kids, for example, you know, they're a lot they're a lot more articulate than I ever was. They know more than I knew at their age. But I'm not sure the hard lines of our experience have changed that much or if they ever really do. You're defined by your gender and you can try and break out of that and you can look for opportunities. But a woman is a woman and a man is a man.
Mm. And you've got some great actors, don't you, starring? There's a lot of very strong female roles.
Yes. I have Stella McCusker playing Grandma Frecklin. Mae Fitzgerald is playing the May. Marion O'Dwyer is one of the aunts and Michael Fitzgerald is playing Robert. So there are eight or nine in the cast. I'm trying to remember, I think.
Yeah.
And Andrew Flynn is directing and his theatre company is Decadence. And Andrew has a huge track record directing Irish plays and touring them around the country. So I think people around the country will know his style and, you know, his values and how he presents things. I mean, he does great work. And he does great work, I think, taking the plays around the country, where a lot of theatre companies tend to be centred in the cities. So it's exciting, and it's exciting. I'm going in to see them now this week, and I'll have a look, and they'll do a run through for me. And, you know, actors are just great people to be around.
Would you still get nervous about it? I mean, it's not a new play, so it obviously, and you've won so many awards, it was received so well the first time, but would you be nervous now?
Yes, of course, yeah. And also because something you wrote nearly 30 years ago, you look at and you say, oh my God. But I'm like that with something I wrote yesterday as well. So, you know, there's always that. I think, and I don't think I'm alone in this. I was talking to Nancy there earlier. So, you know, there's somebody say, oh God, what was I thinking writing that? And I love sitting in theatres when there's a new play of mine on, because I always think, oh, that'll give me, you know, gives me ideas for the next play. But you're rewriting it as you're watching it. So there's always a sense in which the thing is unfinished and movable. And I suppose that's one of the interesting things about theatre, that it's different with every audience, with every cast, with every interpretation.
And I suppose you were talking yourself about the places in which we all get influenced by. Tell us about Pallas. Isn't a Pallas Lake in County Offaly? Is that where you began? Is that where you grew up around there?
I grew up on a lake. Well, the first 10 years were in the school residence, the other side of the lake. And then my parents built this house on the lake. So it was a magical place. It is a magical place. I was down there recently and the swans came out of the lake again to say hello. And, you know, the light and the mountains and the people.
Actually, David Whelan says, Offaly is so proud of Marina Carr, a woman playwright of tremendous ability. Her works project a modern world beyond person, beyond place. That's a nice tweet.
Oh, that's beautiful.
When did you realise you could write? I'm always fascinated by that. I mean, and you've made, you know, a sterling career as a playwright. But at what age did you think, okay, I could do this as a living?
Well, I wrote my first play when I was in my final year at UCD. And then I went off to America for a year and wrote a couple of other plays. So I don't think I ever consciously said I'm going to be a playwright. I mean, I think it probably helped that my father wrote. He was a playwright and died just in December. So I'm an orphan now at the good old age of 55. I find myself finally an orphan because my mother is dead for decades. But I think it was in the house, and, you know, there were musicians, there was poetry there. My mother was writing poetry in Irish. So it wasn't like a huge leap for me. It seemed quite a natural thing to do.
Is it, when you just said there that you're an orphan, do you think that is a real moment in people's lives when both of their parents are no longer around?
I think it probably is. I think it takes a while to realise that you are. There's nothing now between you and eternity. You know, you're at the top of the mountain now. You're the next one.
Chilling thought.
Heading off the mountain into the nowhere or wherever you believe you're going.
Like Nancy Harris as well, I mean, some of your recurring themes are female sexuality, motherhood, love, desire. Even like, I think Portia Coughlin was postnatally depressed. The May is full of female sexual desire. These aren't subjects that are often written about. Why do you think this is? I mean, it's important they are written about, but they're not often written about.
Well, I suppose, you know, coming out of De Valera's Ireland, and my parents would have been De Valera children. There was an awful lot of repression. There was an awful lot of cruelty. I think the New Republic was very, very hard on women and children, and a lot of men as well who weren't in power. And it was a society, I think the repressions were quite severe and the judgment was quite severe. And we're only coming out of that now, I think. And, you know, I think traditionally those themes might not have been allowed to be expressed by women. They were, of course, written about by men. Famously Joyce. He does a good turn on women. I don't know. A mixture.
There are also, I know I have two today, but there are far too few women playwrights Why is this? And we've women novelists. So why so few women playwrights?
Well, I think that's changing slowly. I think it's about opportunities. I mean, it was a man's game. It was a boy's game. And the struggle to get work on, it has been quite a struggle. You know, and maybe I've been luckier than most, but even within that, I've had a lot of rejection in my life and a lot of criticism to deal with. And I think hopefully that is changing a bit now, that it's that there's more room for all of us to be heard.
Lots of nice reaction to you here. One of our listeners says, Miriam, I went to see The May in Galway last year. What a really excellent play. The two old ladies were so sharp and funny. Another says, wonderful to hear Marina Carr. Will always be linked for me to the great Monica Frawley. Their Boggart Cats collaboration was magical. Fond memories of Palace Lake and of her inspirational mother. So like Marina in many ways. That's Seamus Dooley. Another says, we carry our mothers and fathers in our hearts and our heads. That's from Ed and Gorey. That's obviously you talking about that. And one more says, great to see the Blue Bulls, Palace Lake finest in County Offaly. On Miriam this morning, I saw her Boggart Cats play in London with the late Tom Hickey in the early 2000s. Very powerful. It stayed with me. And one more by Boggart Cats, gorgeous play that reaches into your soul. Go, Marina.
Oh, that's nice, lovely. Thank you for all the Offaly support. Up Offaly is all I can say. Thank you so much.
Yeah, but I suppose also it's a cliche, but if you can't see it, you can't be it. And maybe for a lot of younger playwrights, just starting off, when they see someone like you, and even Nancy Harris, and he said big success, that will maybe encourage them to keep trying to make it.
Yeah, and I teach playwriting and drama in GCU, and there's a whole gang of them coming up now. You know, they're writing for The Fringe, and they just had the Seen and Heard Festival, and some of my students at work in that. And that's wonderful to see. And I think it is, you know, we must be hopeful.
And humour, of course, specifically black humour with you, it's very important. Your writing, isn't it important to have that balance between, I suppose, the super serious issues you touch upon and the black humour?
Yeah, well, if there isn't humour, I mean, we all fall asleep. You know, we need a bit of levity, shall we say. But I think, you know, you can't be too serious about things.
I know you do have discipline in your work. I was about to say you have four children. If that was a male playwright, I probably wouldn't say that to him.
No, so I'm very proud of my children.
Hello, yeah. But do you have a discipline about how you write?
Not as disciplined as I should be, yeah. Sometimes. Sometimes I get so flustered I actually stop writing. You know, I'll be in the middle of a sentence. I say, no, that's enough, or there are too many other things going on. When I have to, I do, but I'm lazy as well. I also need a lot of time to think.
Yeah.
You know, we need solitude and, you know, you need your coffees and your glass of wine and your books and, you know.
Yeah, solitude is nice, isn't it? Well, look, The May, with lots of people saying how much they love it, it's going to be in the Gaiety Theatre here in Dublin from the 24th to the 28th of March. And it's touring Ireland in March and April. And for more, all our listeners can go on to decadenttheatrecompany.ie.
Great.
Listen, Marina Carr, it's been a privilege.
Thank you,
your
Maria.
Great writing. One of our listeners says, as a Laois woman, I also love Marina Carr. I love her use of the local dialect. Another Jan Stokes says, great to listen to the brilliant Marina Carr. She's a fantastic teacher too and was a real inspiration to me. And one other, Damien White says, say hello to Marina Carr for me, an old school friend. Her mum was the most inspiring teacher ever. When we move on, the new series of the great T.G. Cahir series, Le Croquel, begins this Thursday evening, profiling the champions. And first up is one of Kerry's greatest ever players, Kieran Donaghy. And I'm delighted to say that Kieran joins me on the line now from his home in Tralee. Good morning, Kieran.
Morning, Miriam. How are you?
Very good. And listen, it's your birthday. Happy birthday.
Thanks a million. Thanks a million.
Are you going to do anything special later?
No, I have a basketball game with the Tralee Warriors at 6 o'clock in Castle Island. So we have 3 games to go and we're currently top of the league by a point. So it'll be nothing too special. I had pancakes this morning, which is a bit of a treat.
And actually, that's so interesting, Kieran, because not everyone knows everything about your career. And your documentary going on Thursday is fantastic. But you have this incredible love for basketball as well. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it's just, I suppose it's my first love, my true love. I was kind of a basketballer, made into kind of a footballer, I would classify myself as. So I never really felt overly comfortable on a football pitch like I would have on a basketball court. I gave up football for 2 years when I was kind of 15, about a year and a half when I was 15, 16. So I wasn't that good. I was on the bench all the time. So if there's any young kids that are struggling to get on their team when they're 15 and 16, there's hope, yes.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And then you got lost in a world, I know you say in the documentary, of trying to be Michael Jordan.
Yeah, I suppose even my birthday presents this morning from my wife were a pair of Michael Jordan boots and a Jordan tracksuit. So I'm still kind of a bit obsessed. But yeah, look, he was, I suppose, when we were young, we didn't have kind of the Twitter world that's around now. So it was, you'd get a tape from America, maybe, or you'd get a tape for Christmas, something. He had documentaries at the time, he had three or four of them. And yeah, I used to just watch them on repeat, really, and I knew them word for word. I could rhyme them off for you by the time I was finished with them. But that was, you know, I used to go out the back, you know, to shoot, and I could be out there and the neighbours would be ringing my grandmother at 10 to 1 in the morning saying, would you tell the young fella stop bouncing the ball outside? So they were, as well as Michael Jordan being my inspiration, the local team here, the Three Tigers at the time, would have been another inspiration. And yeah, I got caught up in a world of basketball, and I'm still caught up in it at the moment. So it's a huge thing in my life. And I still train three nights a week with the Garvey Street Warriors, and yeah, it's ever present.
And interesting, leadership, Kieran, is very important to you, I know, and learning how to be a mentor to the team you captain, but also the children. You mentioned you coach basketball too. And I know you do an Easter camp with children, but don't you begin every morning of the camp talking to those young children about bullying and online bullying, Kieran?
Yeah, we do talks at the start of each morning of the camps. I do them at Easter and Halloween. And yeah, just, I think kids kind of, you know, I've two kids myself, and they don't really listen to me. So I think they listen to other people more, and especially sports people. So yeah, I talk to them about you know, how to deal with online bullying and bullying in general. But I think bullying, you know, is something that is kind of hopefully dying down a bit. But the online bullying is certainly ramped up, and is very dangerous for young people. So I do talk to them about how to handle this and how to not be a part of it, more importantly, but that if they are a part of it, to stop, and if it's coming your way, to tell people, to talk to people, and even to be, you know, I try and talk to them about resilience as well, because we have to be real that it is around. And I kind of try and talk to them about, you know, that even my own life, when I'm not playing well, there'll be certain people who would have goes at me, and it's a form of bullying, this trolling that goes on, and how I try and deal with it and try and realise that, you know, that it, these people are talking behind a keyboard, and that's easy to do, and that to not take too much attention of it, and to talk to those who really care about you, really close friends. I talk to them about friendships and teammates in sport. I often say, you know, I have enough friends in my life, but teammates are you know, crucial people in your lives, because, you know, when you have a bond with somebody and you train with somebody hard and you go to the well with them, you can always go talk to them, because they always have your back. And that's what I try and kind of get across to them. I talk to them about trying to be a good teammate. I always encourage the better people at the camp to try and help a beginner get a basket or something, because that basket to a beginner could be a huge kind of lift in their lives if they're struggling with the sport or a sport in general. So trying to make the better kids at my camp become more aware of how to lift somebody around them, more so than just going out scoring themselves. So yeah, we do that, but then, like, that's 15 minutes at the start, and then we just go on and try and have as much fun in the day and try and show them as much as we can.
And I suppose, well, you're talking there about camaraderie and the friendship within sport. I mean, my listeners, probably many of them will know, I think you're a four-time All-Ireland champion, three All-Star winner. But what, when you look back on your career, Kieran, what is the highlight for you? What are the highlights? And is it the friendships you built up or the moments of glory when you win?
I think the moments of glory are great, but they're fleeting in a way. They last for a few days, so you couldn't kind of pin your career on them. It is the friendships, it is the bonds, it is the conversations I have weekly with all teammates. And, you know, it's been able to sit across from a guy in 30 years and have a pint of Guinness and kind of talk about, you won't talk about the good times all the time. You'll talk about certain instances, certain things that happened where, you know, you had someone's back or they had your back, and it's that kind of mutual respect between teammates, which was something that I always, you know, always think about. And that's, you know, I hope that, you know, when I retired, that was the best thing about when I retired, was what my teammates said and came out and said after that, was about that I was a good teammate. And that was probably most important to me. I was always kind of trying to make those around me, I suppose, better, because I had a certain skill set, and it wasn't necessarily a man that could win a ball and take on guys and kick scores all day long, but it was about, you know, fighting for the team and winning ball and giving it to the good, better footballers around me to do the damage. And when my chances came, you know, I was fortunate enough to take some, but I missed some as well. But it is that kind of bond that you build up with your guys that you'll be able to have, I suppose, forever, more so than the fleeting moments of success. When they happen, they are great, don't get me wrong. I fought my whole career to win, but I played 15 years and, you know, I only won 4 All-Irelands. I played in 8 finals. I lost 4 as well. So I know all about winning and losing, and you can't just base it around that. It's the journey. And I certainly realized that more as the end of my career was coming. I knew that, you know, probably from a few years out, I knew my time was nearly up, but I kept going, I kept playing. And yeah, I started my last game in Killarney and finished my days at Kerry at 14 in Fitzgerald Stadium, where a lot of it started for me. So that was a nice kind of finish for me.
And as you say, look, you've had such great success on the field, Kieran, but when do you think sport, though, especially as a young man, teaches you how to deal with difficulties in life? Because as you said, you also have the days where you lose the match, you lose the All-Ireland. So you have to deal with, you know, failure in sport. Does it teach you a lot going forward in life?
It does. It makes you resilient, absolutely. I say that to the kids all the time about sport. I says, you know, when they play as much sport as they can, you're going to lose more than you win. There's every time there's a number of teams start off to win something. There's only one at the end can be the winner. So, you know, I tell them that you're going to how to lose and how to be graceful when you lose and how to accept it. And yes, it may be hard and it may be difficult, but nobody has died. You know, I always tell them that, you know, it the pain will ease after a while. But, you know, don't get me wrong, I was training hard to win my whole career, so that the losses did hurt. But, you know, it does build a resilience in you. That's very important in life, because kids coming up nowadays, you know, they're going to lose games, but more importantly, when they get on in life, they're going to be going for jobs that they mightn't get. They're going to be going through certain instances in their life where they want something, they don't end up getting it. And it's how to accept that and how to deal with it and how to kind of come again and, you know, show that resilience and don't let anybody tell you you're not good enough and put the head down and that you'll get there eventually if you want it bad enough. And that's certainly what I found out through my career, because, I, you know, there was tough days and all that, but I always just kept the head down and kept working and stayed positive. I think positivity is a big thing in sports and in life in general. And, you know, the negative energy zappers that could be around you, to stay away from them and to surround yourself with positive people who see the bright side of things and who will help you get to places that you want to go get to.
And this documentary on Thursday, I mean, it's not just about your sports career, and into every life comes some difficulties or sadness. And I know you speak about your dad. Sadly, he's no longer with us. But briefly, I think, was your dad an alcoholic and then you kind of fell out, but you wished you'd almost reconciled with him? Tell us about that, Kieran.
Yeah, look, he struggles, the poor man. He struggles with alcohol and gambling. But, you know, he had a very good side to him too. And, you know, I talk about it because I did fall out with him. There was a falling out. And, you know, it's a hard thing to deal with when you fall out with somebody and they die and you don't get to get that time back and to talk it out. Because, you know, no matter what the issues are, I think we should all, I think I say in the documentary that I wish I was a bigger man and kind of and had that chat before the time is out. So if you are struggling or fighting with loved ones, like, you know, their family at the end of the day, and yes, they might have flaws and they might make mistakes, but sure, we all make mistakes in life. And some people get punished for them, and some people are, you know, alcoholism and gambling are diseases in a way. So you have to kind of see that side of it, and anybody struggling with any type of addiction, you know, to try and see the good and try and get around the negative side of it. And time if time was different, you would have that out and try and reconcile with them. And but look, you know, you don't get that chance sometimes, and you have to deal with that as best you can. And you know, it was tough when the day came to bury him, and you're standing there in the room, kind of, you know, I was by myself looking at him, and kind of that was the kind of conversation that was going on in my head. And there was a bit of anger there as well, because I was saying, look, you'd such a beautiful wife, you'd three beautiful kids, and you know, but again, you got to bring yourself back to the disease that these things are, and that, you know, people can't see straight with them. So that we you know, you have to kind of rally around them and try and keep helping them to see the light and to not give up on that, I would say.
Yeah, well, Kieran, wise words, and your father would be very proud of you, as I know your mum is. And look, it's a great documentary. It's going out this coming Thursday, 9:30, TG Cahir, in that great series, Le Croquel. Happy birthday, Kieran Donnelly, and thanks for chatting to us this morning. Have a great day.
Thanks, Miriam. All right, okay.
Take care. Look after yourself. Lovely reaction to Kieran Donaghy there. One of our listeners says, I love the attitude of Kieran about getting stronger players to build up other players around them. I do this at work and building up resilience. He should be giving parents advice. And another Sean Lyon says, great to hear Kieran on Miriam, a generous man in so many ways. Well, we move on. Nancy Harris is fast emerging as one of our most talented playwrights, hailed as having a razor-sharp wit and a subversive insight into fractured relationships. Nancy's plays have been produced both here and in the United Kingdom, where she now leads to superb reviews. Her new play, Our New Girl, is currently at the Gate Theatre here in Dublin. And Nancy Harris joins me now in studio. Good morning, Nancy.
Hi, Miriam.
It's such a joy. Two playwrights in one day. Listen, tell me about Our New Girl. What's the story? Tell me about it.
Well, it's the story of the play is it's set in London, and a woman, a kind of an upper middle class woman, is the opening scene. Is she finds herself in a kitchen with an Irish nanny called Annie, who says, "Your husband has hired me to be a nanny to help you." And the woman has never seen this before. And her husband's a doctor who works in war-torn countries, a place where there's natural disasters. She can't get hold of him by phone to verify if this woman is supposed to be hired as a nanny. And so it begins on a note of kind of unsettling. Why is this woman here? And then slowly the nanny kind of infiltrates the home of this upper middle class family and starts to watch what's happening in the family, and secrets and troubling kind of things are kind of going on, and under the kind of gaze of this, I suppose, foreigner or alien in the house, who's Annie. Yeah.
It's a fascinating plot. And then, because the mother herself, I find this very interesting, she doesn't really bond with her child. She doesn't explain that.
No. So the play is kind of dealing with that taboo. It's not, she hasn't bonded with the child. And so what it is, it's sort of that kind of fractious relation. It's about the idea of, I suppose, the maternal instinct. And is it a natural instinct? And what if it isn't? And I suppose what's difficult with a play, like what's interesting is a whole marriage, because I think the thing that's come out from this production, because this play has been on before in London and places like that. But this production, it's about a marriage under a microscope in a way. Like when you're parenting, skills are being watched by someone else, or your marriage, the embarrassing arguments you're starting to have, when you're kind of held under a microscope, what happens? How do we feel when we're being looked at by a stranger? And also, what does that do to the stranger? Because of course, she's her own person with her own story. And so it's all of these things, and she's got her own story of motherhood. So it's everything kind of combusts in this kind of shiny, perfect kitchen in London is kind of the setting of the play.
It's so interesting, because when you think whether it's an au pair or a nanny, looking at it, it obviously is quite an intimate role. Despite, you know, people may try to make it a business arrangement, it's not like any other job, really, because you are watching someone else.
You're in a family. You're supposed to kind of be there and not be there. It's a really difficult role, because you're supposed to just kind of slot into the family. And yet, what if you're watching something that is deeply uncomfortable, or you feel is crossing a line, or you feel someone's treating their child in a way that you don't approve of? So where does the line go? Where do you just say nothing and just do your job? And when do you step in and actually say no? I think so. It's all about boundaries, lines, transgressions on everybody's part. And when the husband comes back, it's what happens then. So it's kind of each character. The aim, I hope, is that every character to some extent you start to understand, whether you sympathize with them or not, I don't know. But it kind of moves you through kind of seeing things from each person's perspective.
And like I was saying to Marina Carr earlier, Nancy, it's really interesting because writing about a mother who doesn't really bond with her child at all, it is a taboo. No one writes about that really that much.
Well, you can't. I think Marina probably writes about it.
Yeah.
You were talking about women's stories and why, but I think it's because we haven't heard from women that much. We haven't heard about these things, but women are not afraid of this subject. I think we have so many ideas about motherhood that are starting to be talked about and broken open. And I think the reason people don't talk about it is, how do you talk about it? Because we're all children. So how would we feel if our parents turned around and said, this wasn't easy, or maybe I shouldn't have done this, or this was maybe the wrong decision? What would we do?
We probably never say it.
What do you do as the child? Yeah. So it is a taboo.
Really interesting. And of course, this is the staging of your play. I think it was first performed in 2012. Mm-hmm. It's already toured, I think, as far afield as Chicago and Finland. And it won rave reviews. I was looking them up last night in London. The Guardian called it an unsettling psychological drama. Does it mean a lot, though, to have it back here in Dublin in the Gay Theatre?
Yeah, it means everything. I think it's the most, to me, it's obviously the most important one because it's your home. But also, when I watched it in London, the London audience were that family, the London family, whereas the audience here is kind of the nanny. So it's watching it, we're kind of watching ourselves as an outsider coming into someone's home. So it's quite interesting from that sort of angle too, of how there's different jokes, they land differently here, that there's lines that never people didn't laugh at before that like an Irish audience will get. So there are just certain things that translate differently here. And every play, every production is different because of a director, Annabel Cummins, directing it. And she's bringing her own eye to it. So there's different things coming out that I've never seen before.
It's great because you live in the UK now. I mean, I think your first original full-length play, No Romance, it won you the Stuart Parker Award.
Yeah.
It was, of course, staged at the Abbey. And Our New Girl, of course, saw you being shortlisted for the Evening Standard Most Prominent Playwright Award in 2013. So you've had a lot of success. Mm-hmm. But at what stage, I asked Marina Carr this, did you know you could be a playwright? At what stage did you think, I can do this?
Well, I was listening to Marina and she wrote her first play in her final year of university, and I wrote my first play in my final year of university. But it was a troubled year. And so when I wrote it, it was kind of a relief I basically picked playwriting because it was the only course where you didn't have to write an academic essay and I was drowning in stuff. So I picked playwriting because I thought all I have to do is write a one-act play. And I wrote it very quickly. And what happened was people seemed to like it. My lecturer was like, send it out. And I didn't actually know that I could ever do it again. I thought maybe it was an accident. Maybe it was a fluke. Maybe I have nothing further to say. So I actually didn't know that I could be a playwright. It took a while. It took being able to do it a couple more times and getting it wrong and getting it right. That eventually you start to kind of think, yeah. But something in it, when I wrote that first play, something about it just felt natural. And also, I think I've always been interested in how people speak, like the kind of absurdities in our conversation or accents or the different cadences. And I think that's something that playwrights, particularly their ear, it's kind of musical. And I think if you have an interest in how people talk, that sort of tends to, because even in books, when I'm reading a novel, I tend to still go to the dialogue because I think that's where the story is going to be, even though it's not. But I think that's a sort of a tell, maybe, of a playwright.
Were you always a good writer? I often ask that, you know, when people in school, like, were you good at English in school? I mean, both of your parents, Anne and Owen Harris, super writers, but were you always a good writer?
Not a particularly exceptional writer in English. I think I really loved English, but I don't think I would have been. I think for me, I wrote privately at home. I was a compulsive writer. I filled notebooks. And I used to, as a kid, tell myself stories. Like to be fair to my poor parents, they were very kind about it. I used to close the door and tell myself stories. And
That's your imagination.
It's your imagination run free.
Which is
but
great.
It was interesting. But I... I don't think I stood out particularly in school. I think what happened was I felt writing was a really private thing, a personal thing. And then playwriting was the thing that actually allowed me to do it on a more public scale.
And I think Selena Cartmell, it was important when she asked you to do the red shoes at the gate, wasn't it? That was almost a turning point for you. Would that be right?
Yeah. I mean, again, yeah. Just listening to Marina, I think one of the things that's maybe misunderstood about playwriting is there's no, just because I thought once I get a play on, that'll be me set. I'll be just getting plays on and that's how you be a playwright. And actually it's not true. You might have a play, you might have five plays on and then suddenly you can't get a play on for love nor money. And, you know, I had a few plays on, I had some success, and then there just came a point where I'd be writing them and they just, for whatever reason, it wasn't that they were bad plays or they just couldn't get a production. And so I kind of went through this period of not being able to finding it hard to get work on. And I think Selena asking me to do the red shoes sort of brought, I don't know, changed the energy. And it also got me to do something I'd never done before, which was working with dance and music and things like that.
When you were growing up, did you always love theatre?
Sometimes. Mm. I think, you know, I went to theatre. Sometimes I enjoyed it and sometimes I thought it was really boring. Mm. I think if it was brilliant, then you love it. But I didn't. I grew to love it more and more as I started to. I think when you see your first really great play, you can get addicted because you realise fast what the difference between theatre and any other art form. You're in a room with an audience.
Now you are getting married, because it's kind of an interesting story though, because you're marrying a fascinating man to me, but he's not a writer. He's the opposite of you in a way.
He's the opposite. He's a chemistry teacher.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, he's a chemistry teacher and he's a scientist. So he literally is completely the opposite. And he's very understanding, I think, of the demands of a writer, of having to be locked in a room, writing and isolation and time on your own. Yeah, he's
a chemist, really. Is this another way? He's possibly got a really rational brain.
Very rational. Yeah. And we do have some kind of tussles over the rational versus the irrational. And he kind of thinks that I kind of pluck ideas out of the air and make arguments based on that without kind of backing up with facts and figures.
But it's interesting. He comes from Ghana, doesn't he?
He does, yes.
And he said, I think on viewing your adaptation of Tolstoy's The Kreutzer Sonata, he said, where did that come from, that darkness and that rage? I don't know that side of you.
Well, he hasn't seen this play either. And I would be nervous because I think you have to be completely, to write well, you have to be unselfconscious. Mm. And you have to be willing to go to the darkest places in yourself, to the most vulnerable places in yourself. You have to be willing to kind of frighten yourself a little bit. And sometimes it can be very revealing, sometimes in very uncomfortable ways. And I think there's always that moment when, I don't know, your neighbours come and see your play and suddenly they thought you were a perfectly pleasant, normal person and then they're watching some craziness unfold. And I think it can be the same for partners, especially this play, which is very much about a relationship under strain and things coming out, people saying things to each other that, you know, in front of a nanny that feel shocking. And I think a partner, I think he would definitely have some thoughts about this play. And I wrote it before I met him.
Interesting. But maybe, I think you think it might be part of Brexit. Didn't you say recently you experienced with him some racism?
Yeah.
It's a subject I'm really interested in. Was that in London?
Well, he's from Ghana and we were together on a bus. Yeah, there was just a man shouting because we were mixed race. So because we were a couple, each of us, just a man started shouting kind of racist slurs, sexual slurs at us. And it was quite shocking. Yeah, because I mean, a city like London, which is so multicultural and diverse, it's not something that you expect. And I don't know that it was definitely because of Brexit, but it just felt that it was shocking. We feel like we've moved on, and I don't necessarily think that the world has moved on sometimes in ways.
It probably helps us that you live somewhere like London, because it is, I suppose, I mean, we have great theatre here, but it's just on a completely different scale in London. Do you find it helps your writing to live somewhere as big as the theatre world in London compared to Dublin?
I think the theatre in Dublin is amazing and we've got some incredible artists here. I think some of the best work I've seen ever is in Ireland. So I just think what there is in London is just bigger. There's just more stuff, which can be really helpful in terms of opportunity. Although there's more people, there's more playwrights in London too. So everyone's kind of scrabbling for the same bit, the same bit of attention. So, but I don't, I think it suited me to go to a bigger city, but it was hard as well, because it wasn't, I didn't know anyone and I had to kind of start. And also there, what things that a London audience were interested in were not necessarily that, like Ireland has gone through a lot in the last 10 years with abortion and gay marriage. We've really changed. And I think ideas of Ireland had stayed somewhat old fashioned in the UK. So I think I kind of struggled with that a little bit in trying to write about the Ireland I was from versus the Ireland they thought Ireland was.
But do you love living there now?
I do. Yeah, I like it. I do like it. I do love it. It's a brilliant city. But I, you know, I like to come home as well. It's but yeah.
And the question I asked Marina as well, are you disciplined about your writing? Because so many different writers I interview, I'm lucky to interview a lot of writers, but, you know, some people get up and they'll work from 9 to 12. And are you disciplined in how you write?
I am. Because I wouldn't do it. I think it's, I am quite disciplined. I do, my partner says, like, he's like, you don't know what you're like when you're doing a play sometimes because the door is closed. And if he walks outside and there's a creaking floorboard, I can be like, you've just distracted me in the middle of a line, which sounds mad. But it's, I am disciplined to a point. But then sometimes, you know, it just doesn't come and you can't force it. And as Marina said, you do need time to think. Sometimes you just need just time to think, and it's not about writing. And I think writers can really beat themselves up a lot because you feel like you have to be writing, and actually you do have to be thinking and reading and inspiring yourself and all of that too.
Do you allow yourself though moments of great happiness and joy? So now that your play is going to be on the gate, would you enjoy that or will you be nervous?
I'll be nervous.
Yeah,
I'm always nervous. I wish you could just sit back and be like, yeah, that's that. But you can't, because it's always new. It's something new every time.
Yeah. It would probably be strange if you weren't nervous in a way. Do you watch people, like if you're in a theatre, and do you look around to see how the audience is reacting?
Yeah, you can't avoid how, you know how the audience is reacting because you can feel it, even if you didn't look at them. You can feel the dynamic in a room. And also every audience is different. You can get giggly audiences, you can get silent audiences, you can get shuffle, you know, they're just all, but you can tell, even if you looked at no one, you'd sort of know what the feeling in the room is.
Well, Our New Girl by Nancy Harris, it's running, I think, from Thursday, February the 27th. Mm-hmm. At the gate, but the opening night is this coming Wednesday, March the 4th. And it's for 3 weeks only. Mm-hmm. But as I said, all the reviews beforehand have been phenomenal, including by Michael Billington in The Guardian, who's a man who doesn't say many great things about a lot of plays. So, but Nancy Harris, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much
morning.
For having me.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Now stay with me because Hudson Taylor have arrived back in. They're going to sing us out. Mm-hmm. That's Alfie and Harry Hudson-Taylor, your brothers, of course, from Dublin, making a great name for yourself in recent years. Your new album, Loving Everywhere I Go, is just out. You sang earlier, Old Soul, and you've a lot of concerts coming up, haven't you?
We have loads coming up, yeah. Loads. We're actually playing this week, doing kind of in-stores for the album. So we play like performances in the shop and we'll do sort of CD signings and stuff. So we're playing today in Newbridge in Golden Discs, tomorrow in Rollercoaster Records in Kilkenny, Tuesday in Golden Discs in Waterford, Wednesday in Steamboat Records in Limerick, and Thursday in OMG Zuago in Galway.
Yeah, all over the place over the next year.
Yeah, and when you write your album, do you write it together?
Loads of different.
Song was written in a different way. Yeah, either in the bedroom, sometimes together, kind of jamming like we are now, you know, and sometimes in a studio.
Well, and just to say, you're going to play us out. I think the song you're going to play is What Do You Mean?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Don't start just yet. Okay. Our competition winner today is Bernard Carr. Congrats, Bernard, from Roscarron, County Cork. You won the tickets to the Pet Shop Winners. Lots of love online for you, Nancy Harris. I just bring you to Agree With Nancy. Best theatre in the world is in Dublin. London Just Bigger. Keep up the great work. Another says, so great to hear Nancy speak about her recent play. She's been a brilliant trailblazer since our days in Trinity, always dealing with the big and difficult issues. And happy birthday. That's from Rosie.
That's lovely. Yeah. That's really nice.
So listen, my thanks today on sound to Sheila Neve Weil. Denise Davies was our BCO. Sean O'Gorman produced, and we're going to go out listening to Hudson Taylor with their song What Do You Mean?
Thank you. One, two, one, two, three, one.
when I was younger, not so insecure. I didn't care at all when we hopped the wall, care at all when we took a fall. I wanna be there, don't need a reason why. I wanna feel that beat running in my feet, feel that beat of you and me. It won't be too long, sing that old song. Do 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 do. What do you mean it don't mean nothing? What do you mean we can't go back? What do you mean? What do you mean? What do you mean? What do you mean you don't remember how it feels to be young? What do you mean? What do you mean? What do you mean? Yeah! I wanna love you. I wanna love you more. I wanna go, go, go till the sun don't show. Go, go, go till they tell me no. Don't need a reason, it's just a feeling, oh. I'm gonna go, 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 go with the flow. Go, go, go till they tell me no. It's coming so soon, sing that old tune. Do, 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 do. What do you mean it don't mean nothing? What do you mean we can't go back? What do you mean? What do you mean? What do you mean? What do you mean you don't remember how it feels to be young? What do you mean? What do you mean? What do you mean? Don't mean nothing. What do you mean we can't go back? What do you mean? What do you mean? What do you mean? What do you mean you don't remember how it feels to be young? What do you mean? What do you mean? What do you mean? What do you mean it don't mean nothing? What do you mean we can't go back? What do you mean? What do you mean? What do you mean? I'm gonna go, 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 go with the flow. Go, go, go till they tell me no.
What do you mean?
What do you mean? What do you mean? I'm gonna go, 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 go with the flow. Go, go, go till they tell me no.
What do you mean? What do you mean? What do you mean?